one of you, and particularly a special warm welcome to all our guests here this afternoon, who've travelled no doubt from some very interesting places, no doubt best incremental places in terms of the weather, but welcome to Cape Town. At least the sun is shining. You're quite lucky in that regard. This is the final leg of our series in the public hearings that we initiated already last year, where we invited comments on the crucial issue of access and quality education as it pertains to our schools. The response, I must say, has been overwhelming. We've received written submissions, almost 300 written submissions, from members of the public, and we've not actually been able to invite each and every one who has submitted to come to the oral phase. But what we will be doing as a committee as from next week, and this is as much for the information of the members as it is to all of you, we will from next week be going through every single written submission and looking at recommendations and best practices and devising a report. The report will then be tabled in Parliament, and if the House accepts the report, hopefully the recommendations that we make in the report will be referred to the National Department of Education for consideration and implementation. And we hope, as a result of our efforts, to actually have a debate in the House where the Minister and Deputy Minister and the Department per se will actually come and respond to the report that we table. So that's really the process that, in a nutshell, is what we envisage. This week we'll see the final leg of the oral submissions. We hope to finish all of the oral submissions this week, so by Thursday hopefully we would have done with the oral phase, and as I say, next week we start with looking at the written submissions in committee. From my side, I think that is essentially it. I'm told that some members are having to go to higher education activities and so on. If that is the case, please do proceed while we are continuing. No need to ask for apologies or anything of the sort. And we'll just continue as far as possible into our program without you, and you'll then catch up once the report process happens and so on. I don't know from the part of members if there are any further questions. I take it not, and we can proceed then with our first submission, which I believe is from Dr. Jay Swartz. Good afternoon to you, sir. You're from Leaders in Learning, I take it?
Yes.
And your submission really hinges on the issue of cognitive processes in the learning process, as well as the language challenge and the critical issue of HIV. We have, what are these, Mr. Brown? Addendums. Oh, not for this one, okay. And this one? Oh, is this, Mr. Swart, you've now given us another submission, or is it just a summary of your... Wonderful. I was about to say to you, I hope that you're going to be able to abbreviate your submission. It's quite lengthy, in about 10 minutes. So I'm going to hand over to you to firstly just introduce yourself and your institution that you represent, and give us a bit of background, and then proceed into your summary, bearing in mind, of course, that we have quite substantive input from yourself.
Thank you. Thank you.
been involved in education in South Africa for 41 years, primarily as a teacher, and for the last 35 years I've been training. So I have extensive experience as far as that is concerned. My doctorate was from assisting African learners to pass first year at university. In 1988, Helen Suzman put forward a question in Parliament as to why African students were not permitted to enter historically white universities, and one very bright minister said because they wouldn't come. I then got a phone call and asked if I would be prepared to take 20 black students and give them academic support, train them to overcome their disadvantaged background. They would then be given permission to enroll at a so-called white university, and they would do a degree. I did that with 4 years of intensive research and supplying them with academic support. I taught them language, I taught them how to think, I taught them how to learn, and they were so successful in obtaining their degrees that the government at that time branded my report as confidential. You can imagine why. In addition to that, I'm mainly concerned with the problem of education in townships and rural areas, although my proposal has to do with all schools, of course. And I have took a lot of time in rural Zululand, for example, living in Durban, and working with both African teachers across the country. I've trained African teachers across the country. And I'm obviously very dismayed, not just at the fact that we have lack of facilities and textbooks and that sort of thing, things beyond our control, but at the teaching methods that are used, not only in the African context. And that is what I want to address today. There is undoubtedly a crisis in education in South Africa, but I do not wish to lay the blame for that at the door of OBE. And what I have to say is not in a sense to replace OBE, but to supplement it and augment it and to clarify. And otherwise we would have wasted a great deal of money. Now, in order to solve a problem, and we do have a very real problem here, you have to identify the cause. And there are two main causes for the problem in the classroom in terms of teaching. OBE came up with one very wonderful term. It describes educators as learning facilitators, and that is the essence of all teaching. The word facilitate means to make easy. And so the job of any teacher, irrespective of the quality of education, or the dispensation, or the curriculum, is primarily to ensure that learners learn by making it easy. Now, the first problem as far as that is concerned is that our teacher training institutions need to be revamped. And my proposal will address that as well. But training institutions teach teachers how to teach, but they do not address learning, and that's the main problem. And that means we're making the assumption that when they enter the classroom, they know something about learning facilitation, and as I've trained over 10,000 teachers, and I'm not exaggerating, that is not true. The second thing is the curriculum. Traditionally, throughout history, curricula have given an outline of the principles on which education should be based, and then have given an indication of the content that has to be covered in every learning area. But no indication, or certainly no clear explanation as to how to facilitate learning within that context. That is what I need to address. Now, if you, in my training, I started by asking them if they understand the concept of intelligence. Then I asked them to define learning, and then I asked them to identify the learning processes that the human brain uses to achieve understanding. And I've been disappointed in almost every occasion I've trained private schools, government schools, the entire spectrum. And I've yet to find a coherent answer. If you had a problem with your motor car engine and had to say to the mechanic couldn't point out the various parts of the motor car engine or how to use the tool, you'd lose faith in that mechanic. We are facing a situation whereby teachers are not even aware of the learning processes that the human brain uses to achieve understanding. Now, the good news is, I've been working in the field of cognitive science for the last 12 to 15 years. Cognitive science is a study of human intelligence and how to enhance brain power, and particularly learning. Learning is the highest function that the human brain can perform. And there are not that many processes. In fact, I consider about 8 processes that the human brain uses. And in order to try to explain this to you, and also to address the issue of differentiation, namely that different people use different learning processes, which is essential for the teacher to acknowledge. I'm going to use an analogy. So for the moment, I'm going to use the right arm in brain. I'm going to ask you to use your imagination. And imagine that you're not in the same room, that you're in the kitchen room, and we're going to prepare a meal. Now, I've decided to make macaroni and cheese. And the first step in making a meal successfully is to have all the ingredients. And that means that you have to have macaroni, obviously have to have cheese. In my macaroni and cheese, you've got to put mince meat, you can eat garlic and onions, you can make white sauce, you can eat flour, milk, etc., etc., butter. And once you have all those ingredients, you're ready to start. That's step one. Step two, you need a source of heat that will change those raw ingredients into the finished product. Unfortunately, you have a microwave oven, you have a stove, you have a place for the top of the oven, if you're outside, you might be using it for barbecue, but you have that source of heat. The third point is that you can use the heat in different ways. You're going to boil the microwave, you're going to fry it, you might make the white sauce in the microwave, and in the end, when you put it all together, it's going to go into the oven and you're going to roast it. That means you have to acknowledge, in a simple process of cooking and thermoform and learning, that there are different processes that you need to use. Now, this is a scenario that we have. Some people like it good at boiling, others better at frying, others at roasting, others at microwaving, but if you aren't able to use all of those processes, finished products, the meal is not going to be better. Also, you need some systems. You need tools, utensils, pots, pans, spoons, spoons, and stuff. And eventually, when you put it in the oven, you'll have your finished meal. Now let's go out of the kitchen into the garden, again my speed, but I'm very fast. In the garden, the first step in facilitating learning is to ensure that you have all the ingredients. These ingredients are knowledge, information, facts. That is partly the teacher's responsibility to ensure that everything the child needs to know in the learning area, given the topic from the curriculum that she's addressing in that lesson, that it's available to the child. It's totally relevant, but that's often where teaching stop. You've given learners information, and you are just going to assume, apparently, that they will know how to cook, fry, boil, microwave, roast, whatever, in order to achieve the understanding, which is the outcome of any curriculum. Now, the second step that you need after you've got all the ingredients is the source of heat. That's a given. Every child has corn skeletons, brain power, and even though it takes a different form, every child has it. Thirdly, now you have to decide how you are going to process the information which you got in the first step that will enable you to arrive at understanding. And there you have a wide variety of choices. If I had to go through very briefly, but I've explored this in the greatest detail, I've identified every learning process the human brain is capable of using, and I know that if we were able to teach children at an early age, and once again later on to consolidate this, we could teach every child to use every learning process, irrespective of the fact that some of them are good at these processes and others are good at the others. Now, that differentiation is based on brain profile, which I have been doing for the last 15 years. We brain profile a child and discover whether he's left or right brain or not. But there are four areas of the brain: upper left, upper right, lower right. In each quadrant of the brain contributes to the learning process. So let's say you're a very right-brained person, and for the sake of this analogy, that means you're good at boiling. Unfortunately, most of the learning processes are located on the left side of the brain. That's been very carefully researched, and I can give you details for the next hour. But you have to use those left-brained processes, even if you're right-brained. And if you're a left-brained, you might have to use some of the few right-brained processes. What are these processes? Just by the way, analysis, you have to be able to analyze information, break it up into a start. The most important process is logical thinking. If you can't think logically, you can't make sense of information. Then we have comparison and contrast, generalization, identification, classification, and above all, conceptualization. I'm not trying to impress you. I've explored every one of those processes, and I've explored the most practical and optimal means of explaining them to learners and how to apply them to various subject contexts. Now, every teacher should be equipped with that knowledge and the skill that goes with it. No teacher is, A, because of the teacher training institutions that focus on teaching, not learning, and B, because of the curriculum that stipulates a lot of principles, many of them idealistic, and indication of content, but no indication on how to implement it. This is what I want to address, and I do it in a totally feasible way. It's not speculative. It's not a theory. I've worked it out in great detail, and it will not force teachers to leave classrooms and to attend long training sessions, which is written in the case of OBE in class of course. How do I intend to go about doing this? I am proposing that I write a very simple, user-friendly manual for every single teacher in the country. It would be given to every school, and that would explain fully the concept which I'm talking about, which is whole brain teaching and learning. Now, the need to use the whole brain, let me go back to another simple analogy so that I can give it some sort of justification. If you are right-handed, 90% of the world's population is right-handed, and therefore that's the stronger hand. If you wanted to do a simple task like peel an apple, then you'd always put the knife in your right hand. But if the left hand doesn't hold the apple, the right hand won't peel. Now that's exactly how learning works. Most learning processes are on the left side of the brain. And over the years, centuries in fact, we've always disregarded the right brain and said it doesn't have much to do with learning. Today we know this. And therefore, even the weaker quadrants of the brain, the right side, have to support the left side in order to learn. And particularly when it comes to the most advanced form of learning, which is conceptualization. I don't have time to elaborate, but believe me, I've explored this and found ways of teaching conceptualization, which is the most essential aspect of learning, especially from grade 6 upwards. Everything from grade 8 to 12 is conceptual. Now, firstly, I will write this manual and it will be available to all schools. Secondly, I propose, because I can't do one thing, do all of this on my own, I'm not a specialist in every subject, I propose to identify excellent teachers, real specialists, in every learning area or every subject field, across the spectrum from the foundation phase up to the SDE phase, and let's say they are city educators. They will put me and I will train them in the whole brain training that teaching them. Once they have had the input and we finalize and we've got a framework for teaching in this country, they then go and from their specialized field, taking topics from the existing curriculum, they compile 5 model lessons based on this framework of brain teaching. And then these lessons are given to me for me to vet, evaluate them, give them back and back, and eventually we read from me, and every teacher comes up with their 5 model lessons which they present to the other group. And there they are open, criticism, assessment, refinement, improvement. Ultimately, when we are happy with the 5 lessons from every phase, every learning area, then we will select one lesson and the teacher will compile that lesson. We will teach it to a genuine, spontaneous group of students. It will be put on the EDD and it will be made available to the school. What every school will then get is a learning facilitation manual, which I will write, in a very user-friendly manner, explaining step by step how to facilitate learning, which is the essence of class and practice. Number 2, they will then have textual copies of the 5 model lessons in every learning area across the spectrum, the 4 phases of education. Number 3, they will then have a DVD demonstrating, and I know many, many schools, and them I work in little schools, don't have that, but the teacher sends the DVD to be available on the show. And that means they will then be encouraged, now that they've understood, because they've read through the manual and have seen the lesson, they will be encouraged to go and develop their own lessons from other areas of the curriculum, and over a period of 2 or 3 years, we could have built up an entire stock of lessons that cover the entire curriculum and are done according to this process of procedure, which I can assure you I've put into practice. I'm not speculating about it. I've worked with hundreds of teachers, hundreds of students, and I've shown them how it works, and it has been very, very successful. Now,
I'm afraid we're running out of time. We've got all of that in written form from you, so thank you very much, sir. Please will you resume your seat, and then I suggest you use the little thingy there, which you've got to press a button before it will activate.
That one. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You can push it off at the moment. And what I'll do is I'll open up for some questions from the floor. members, I've got Ms. Mishwana. Sorry.
I don't understand why
approach that you want to come with particular efforts such as in county and rural areas. Yeah, exactly. I thought it is confusing. As you speak, you say for every teacher, everyone, but there is this implication where you have specified the rural education. And I had a concern with it. Because it does not necessarily follow that if you end up sitting at a rural area, that's when you should. I don't know if you're correct. So that means that it would be. I think when you talk about the culture, that I agree with you. For if it's happening, what's not in the same way for every education, maybe then I understand. But if you start to talk of education, it, and the issue that in that way, then you were told that the veteran would cope and stuff. I was applying the time, but as you spoke on, you talk of the language that you started by dealing with the language. But it's not that they don't cope. It's because if you come to me and sit in the scene of Greek, I will not understand it. There's nothing wrong with their coping action, except that the language is following you most of the time. So that if you start from there, perhaps you will understand what you want to do. I don't think so.
If I may respond.
Have you checked the syllabuses or the curriculums for teacher training at universities when it comes to this topic? Do they provide for this in their curriculum?
Is there anybody else? Okay, can I take the next slot then? Dr. Swart, maybe you want to tell us whether this particular, what do you call it, learning facilitation? Whole brain learning and teaching, whether this is part of the education of teachers anywhere else in the world, number one. Number two, would you also just clarify this aspect? I find it intriguing, and you know, this kind of studying I think is the kind of science that is always developing as we get to learn more and more about how the brain functions and its various applications, etc. What I would be keen to understand is whether you are proposing that this kind of learning for teachers would enable them to enhance and optimize every single learner's potential. As I understand your submission, what you're saying, currently what happens in the classroom is that you have a learning and teaching methodology that doesn't necessarily allow each and every one of the learner to flourish, because people have different strengths and different weaknesses. Are you proposing that this kind of program that I gather you're still going to develop will enable the optimal functioning and learning of each child, regardless of ability and so on, currently within the current context? And then lastly, you do say that you've trained teachers previously and so on, and yet you say that you're still going to develop a manual. Could you maybe just clarify what you mean by that when you say that you've used this in practice and it works, and you can stand by all of that, and yet.
Thank you. That was the first point. Secondly, as far as the curriculum is concerned, the teacher training institution, to answer your question, I myself spent 25 years at two teacher training institutions, at the Faculty of Education at the at University of Stellenbosch, and I was also at a teacher training college which trained primary school teachers, and I'm quite certain that this approach is not adopted simply because the focus is on what we call didactics, and didactics is teaching methodology. And so it is perceived by the various departments within a training institution that student teachers should be given things about administration, general didactics, and get some sort of specialist knowledge about how to teach English or Afrikaans or maths or whatever their subject may be. But the focus is not on learning, and that is where the biggest problem lies. And I would imagine the reason for that is because they don't fully understand learning. I'm not trying to sound superior, but I've devoted 15 years of my life in researching the human brain in terms of the context of learning. And therefore, also, as a question later said, as far as other institutions throughout the world are, I cannot guarantee, of course, what they do, but I have collaborated with some of the top specialists in the world. I've done courses with Dr. Edward de Bono, who's the father of thinking, so I've introduced critical thinking into my approach. I worked with Harvard University, where I did my research for a long time under Professor David Perkins and Professor Howard Gardner, who is the father of the concept multiple intelligence. I worked with Professor Peter Salovey on emotional intelligence. And I won't say that my theories are unique, but I will guarantee that they are very carefully researched. And it isn't all that relevant to me whether they are being used elsewhere. My point when I look at the crisis in education is, does South Africa then not have the expertise to help itself out of this problem? And I firmly believe that it has. I would regard myself as one of the top specialists in this field because I've devoted my life to it. I haven't really done anything else. And I've done it in a very practical sense by going to schools all the time. I offer all my services free of charge because I want to share this with teachers, and I've had the feedback. So perhaps what is more important is whether it works and not so much whether other people are using it. But I would say, because it's a general theory, undoubtedly, there are aspects of my approach to whole brain teaching and learning which would undoubtedly be used in other areas. For example, I've been collaborating with the University of Chicago in Illinois, and they have been using part of this approach, but they've also introduced what I call emotional intelligence, which I haven't had time to talk about. But just generally, my approach is that education should be holistic. And education is not just a cognitive process. It's also got an emotional dimension. And I hope that you will all be reading the article I wrote on the rationale for promoting EQ in schools. I would love to present a course that takes 2 days on emotional intelligence to this committee or to Parliament just to demonstrate the validity and the power of emotion in promoting, for example, anything that you do. It improves your thinking, your relationships, your behavior, your achievements, and above all, your learning more than any other factor. So it isn't just the whole brain teaching and learning approach that I was able to discuss, but it's a much more holistic approach whereby emotions play a role, emotions that enhance academic performance, take the stress off teachers, for example, counter ill discipline in children, instill in their moral values, things like that, and that has to be part of education. The other question was, this is a very much a developing science, and it is absolutely true, as you said, that we are discovering new things every day. We will never fully understand the human brain. It is far too complex. It has 100 billion neurons, and, you know, its power is infinite and will never be fully determined by us. But what we have discovered, and in my personal research, is not going to change. In other words, the way that the brain learns and the contribution of each area of the brain, the left and the right side and the four quadrants, that has been determined thanks to modern technology. I can say unequivocally, this is how the brain learns. And that I can use that information as long as one can make it practical and develop model lessons and demonstrate and clearly explain to the teachers, then this is not going to, we're not going to discover in 10 years' time, oh no, there's a much better way of learning. There is learning, and that's what the brain does. We can't teach it to do new things. And so when it comes to the manual, as you asked me, have I not yet developed it? Yes, I have, certainly. What I'm proposing is that if it were then approved and were to be made available to all the teachers, I would rewrite it in a clear, user-friendly manner using lots of examples. Because of my vast experience in training teachers, I know the sorts of questions that they ask. And so, certainly, I could sit down tonight and write it for you, and in a week's time it would be ready, because I've been working with it for so long. And I've written extensively. I could refer you to my website, but I won't. Yes, I think that was the other question that you asked. I'm just having a look. Oh, yes, the last question was about optimizing every child's potential. I work with ADD children. I work extensively with children that we label as disadvantaged, as we refer to at the beginning, rural areas, and so on. And first of all, there is no difference in intelligence. It's not a question. I mean, if we take social factors into account, there once was a very extensive research project called A to Z, A for Aborigine and Z for Zulu. And through 3 or 4 years of intensive research to determine whether it is a racial group or geographical group or religious group that is more or less intelligent than any other, in the end, not so. And so when I look at the potential, especially of children in townships, because I actually live in quite a Quarterbacker, and that is why I'm so acutely aware of the township situation, then I realize that every one of these students has vast potential. And what I'm proposing in terms of training teachers to facilitate learning will impact on all students, even children that have learning disabilities, certainly with ADD children that I've worked with, and certainly with all your mainstream children. I also run, as far as I know, about the only course in the country for academically gifted learners, and I have a selection of these learners that I identify beforehand. So I work with disadvantaged learners, I work with the mainstream, I work with the gifted, and I have seen that when it comes to learning, as long as the teacher is equipped to understand the learning processes, is given clear and practical guidance, and then he can use his subject knowledge, his expertise in a particular field, it is going to make the biggest impact on quality of teaching in this country compared with anything else we've ever done before. I firmly believe it. As I said earlier, it's not speculative. It's been tested, and because of the immense feedback I've had, I have no doubt at all that this will go down extremely well. It will put an end to the confusion that OBE has caused. I'm not blaming OBE, the implementation wasn't correct. But when Professor Carter Asimov became the new Minister of Education, the first thing he did was we had to rewrite the curriculum in the hope of clarifying things. And even that didn't clarify things, and eventually things have deteriorated to the extent where they are now. That is what is needed. Clarification, not of OBE, but of how to facilitate learning in the classroom. Nothing is more important than that. I know you're going to hear other presentations on school management and a whole lot of other things, but essentially, education in this country and anywhere else is what happens in the classroom. And if your teacher is not equipped, and we cannot assume that teacher training institutions do that, nor does the curriculum help, if he's not equipped to facilitate learning, the situation will not improve. This is a practical means of addressing that urgent need, and I guarantee its success.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
On that note. And let me thank you, and I'm sorry that we don't have more time to spend with you. I'm sure a lot of us would want to hear more from you. But perhaps I should just say that I've not ever met a person that I can definitely say with any degree of surety that he knows his mind. In your case, I could say that with absolute certainty. Thank you very much. What I want to also suggest, Dr. Swart, is if you can actually send us documentation pertaining to projects that you know, schools or teachers that you've worked with, and the kind of empirical data that you spoke about. We don't have that in our file, so that would be something for us to consider when we are doing our report in terms of making proposals. A generic something would be good enough. Thank you very much. Could we move on to the next submission? That is from GM South Africa Foundation, Mr. Matlock. Welcome, Mr. Matlock. We have your submission on your pilot project experience, which you want to share with the rest of the country. So you have 10 minutes as well. And,
Well, thanks very much, Madam Chair. I'm going to break the ice in just a couple of minutes and then hand over to my colleague next to me, Andre Forbes, to go through the meat of the proposal. I've been busy for the past 35 years trying to improve quality of life in South Africa, in housing and education and job creation and everything else. 15 years ago, I was lucky enough to be appointed as the general manager of a new company, a new organization, a new NPO, called the Delta Foundation then. It's now become the GM South Africa Foundation. And we're fully funded by GM, but we are legally an independent agency. And what we are doing is very different from what other foundations are doing. We are identifying critical problem areas in only two categories, really. One is the public school system, and the other one is subsidized housing. Obviously, the former is what we hear about today. What we do is we identify a problem, and we come up with an innovative potential solution for that problem. We test it out in schools on the ground. Ourselves, we manage the project. We don't fund anybody. We do the direct project management. We're very critical at evaluating its success, and we're very quick to modify and adapt what we're doing on the ground until we've got it right. Once we've got it right, we write everything up in the form of what we call a model, but it's a misnomer. It's more of a set of implementation guidelines, and we give those guidelines away to anybody who's interested in copying them or copying some of them. Our target, if you want to call it that, for replication, because that's what we're trying to achieve, is obviously the government. So consequently, we work very closely with the government right from the conceptualization phase through to hopefully helping the government to lodge those models in their policies and in their operating procedures. One of the good examples, and Paulette Tjobeke will know about that, is we started working on a pilot project in Port Elizabeth quite a long time ago on training principals, and got into very close partnership with the Department of Education, and that really formed the backbone for the National ACE, which was reported on in last week's Sunday Times. I'm not saying the whole project is a clone of ours, but we played a major role with the department in getting that ACE up and running, and 16 universities are now implementing it. Andre Forbes on my left here was the project manager of that, and I think the best decision I ever took way back in the foundation's early days was to appoint Andre as education project coordinator. And we're here today, and Andre will be telling you in a minute, we're here today because the foundation firmly believes that there's a structural problem in education, which is the major factor behind the decline in education in South Africa, which we've stopped arguing about and now all acknowledge. That structural problem is this enormous divide that exists between the schools and the office-based officials. Office-based officials never seem to get into the schools. Schools need vast amounts of help. They're not getting help from anywhere at the moment. If they are getting it, it's marginal. You can't leave it up to a few non-government organizations to do it. And we believe that the solution, which Andre will now be presenting to you, is actually to decentralize the district offices and to create circuit teams where experts get into the schools on a regular basis and assist those teachers to come to terms with the difficulties they're having at the moment. To keep everything short, I'm going to end there and hand over to Andre.
Good afternoon, colleagues. Assalamu alaikum. Colleagues, as Roger has stated here, since 1995, since inception of the foundation, all our school-based activities, in fact, all our pilot projects, we were doing within the 9 focus areas of school functionality, have clearly indicated there's a total rethink of the interface between the schools and the Department of Education. The GMSA Foundation, we worked closely way back in 2001 already with the East Cape Department of Education in putting together and conceptualizing a more effective district office system that would bring support and service delivery closer to the schools, right to the doorstep of the schools, end-to-end support. That was way back in 2001. Now, that task team, which was assembled, us and the department at the province, produce quite a large volume of documentation, and we produce a decentralized district office model for the Eastern Cape. Cost, etc., and a set of implementation guidelines. Now, this resulting model implied that the district office needed to move away from the current modus operandi. And what is that? The way they're currently operating is very, very fragmented, very silo-based, very hierarchical, very bureaucratic, and we are proposing that they move to a more developmental, school-focused, circuit team approach. Now, this model, and I'm not going to go into this model, into the details of it, because we forwarded documents to your office, ma'am. It clearly spells out the purpose, the guiding principles, the delivery mechanisms, the training implications, the functionality implications, the costing of the model, the application of this model, etc. But please keep in mind, it is a generic model. And this model, I'm saying to the provinces, if you're going to use it, please adapt it to suit your conditions on the ground. Now, this model was accepted by all key stakeholders, including the Provincial Department of Education in the Eastern Cape, but it was never implemented. I mean, you know what's been going on in the Eastern Cape over the last 10, 12 years. We've had so many MECs, and we've had so many HODs, and currently we still don't have a HOD. Only recently we've had a HOD appointed for the next 3 months, which is a former HOD from the Western Cape. The central feature of this model, what I want to bring to your attention this afternoon, is the concept of a circuit team. The circuit team is recognized as the most critical delivery mechanism in the district office. And there are 81 or 83 district offices across this country. And if you go into any one of those district offices, now except some of the district offices in the Western Cape who have taken this model and adjusted this model to suit their conditions, because today you have the Western Cape, the 8 districts that make up the Western Cape Education Department, running according to circuit teams and circuit offices, which we say is a huge step in the right direction. The circuit team concept allows for the most effective interface and direct interface with the schools, a team of people. Now, the makeup and the operations of the circuit team are informed by the needs of the schools in the circuit and not the other way around. The way our provincial departments are structured at the moment is that we have this huge bureaucracy on top. We fill those blocks and with names and faces without looking at the expertise, and we didn't look at the needs of the school and turn it around and look at the needs of the school and then populate our district organizational structures. So we are proposing a total realignment of the way the provinces are conducting their affairs. If we're not going to do it, we're going to get, we will be put up for the next 16 years with what we've had over the last 16 years. So many districts are structured into circuits of between 30 and 60 schools. And they are overseen by a circuit manager. In some provinces, these people have been referred to as EDOs, like in Eastern Cape, Education Development Offices. In some other provinces, like Gauteng, they have been referred to as IDOs, etc., etc. But this EDO, he visits once every 2 months, because he cannot visit all those schools. So it's one person to oversee 30 or 60 schools, and then when that person eventually gets to a school, currently the way we're operating, collect all the problems at the school, get back into the district office, from curriculum to social welfare to occupational therapy to psychology problems, psychological problems, you collect all those problems, salaries, etc., stationery, and hope somebody in the district office will assist him somewhere. And that person then sends all those problems down into the system. No wonder the schools are saying, we are not receiving teaching and learning support material. Sir, I have not received my salary this month. I have not received my books this month. The curriculum are not being delivered because our principals and our teachers don't know the structure and a way for the organization and the curriculum to be delivered in the school. And it's just overwhelming for these people. So what are we saying? There's no coordinated support to schools. All the different sections in the department, at provincial level, at district level, they all work in silos. The one does not know what the other one is doing with no proper reporting mechanisms in place. So we are saying a new paradigm shift is required to that of a school-focused team approach, work team approach. A team of people drawn from all sections of the district office that sit and plan together once a week on a Monday to deliver the services schools ought to receive from a functional district office, because the majority of our district offices are dysfunctional in this country. So we are saying, folks, under the guidance of highly skilled circuit team leaders, multidisciplinary circuit teams interact with schools on a daily basis and apply end-to-end support services to schools, from social work, to remedial, to curriculum, to occupational therapy, to school psychology, etc. Now, we are currently in Port Elizabeth piloting such a circuit team of all those appropriately skilled people to test the mechanism to see if it can deliver those services to the schools on a daily, on a day-to-day basis. And I can report to you that the project is progressing well at the moment. We are documenting and writing it up. Now, what have we done? I'm finishing up. Despite the Eastern Cape Education Department not implementing the model, ma'am, we didn't sit back. We distributed this model to all 9 provinces across the country. The Western Cape Education Department responded positively, and they are now implementing a slightly modified version of this model. And they have institutionalized and operationalized the circuit team concept. They have declared policy around districts and circuits, and today I can sit in front of you to say to you that the Western Cape, all 8 districts, are structured along circuit teams. Teams of people responsible for a circuit of schools, headed up by a circuit team leader, highly skilled, and they interact with the schools on a day-to-day basis. I don't have to tell you what the end result of that is. Already, that particular arrangement here is paying some huge educational dividends. The systemic evaluation for grade 6 and grade 6, grade 3, literacy and numeracy, pound for pound, they're leading the country in that regard. I'm not going to use the matric result as an example, but there's another example for that. I just want to say to you lastly that we are working close at the moment with the Housing Education Department and the Free State Education Department, because they have decided to realign their organizational structures to make provision for the introduction of circuits and circuit teams. What do we recommend? We would strongly recommend that the National Department of Education establish a national task team to investigate the possibility of the introduction of circuit teams in all 81 districts that make up the National Department of Education. That's the only way that there's direct contact, interface between the department at that level where it's needed and the schools. The draft policy on organization roles and responsibilities of education districts, which is still draft, we think it's an ideal framework for you to conduct such an investigation. There is a policy framework. I don't know when will that policy framework become final. That defines districts and circuits. There's a real danger that the provincial processes could overtake the national development. We believe the National Department of Education should lead this process. In closing, I would like to say, the circuit teams and the circuit offices will bring service delivery closer to the schools and will give the DOE a developmental focus or presence in every school across this country. And in that way, we will make sure that the curriculum and the schools deliver the ultimate, that learner that we need to produce, that learner performance that we're all striving for. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I just wanted to get your name again.
It's Andre Forbes.
Mr. Forbes. Is that with a F-O-B?
F-O-R-B-E-S.
E-S?
Yeah.
E-S. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Forbes. And May I just say that when I read the submission, I found it a bit difficult to understand on paper. You clarified a lot of issues in your submission today, and I guess that what you've really submitted is it would be the kind of blueprint that you would submit as a proposal to your provincial departments or whatever. But I wondered if it was possible for you to, in a kind of a summarized fashion, and when I say summarized, I don't necessarily mean small, but in a way that would explain the issues as you were articulating them today. In other words, what doesn't work currently in the system that you've got with your district offices and your schools being far apart and they're not being able to be supportive of each other and so on? And what is different in your model and how do you almost diagrammatically represent what you're suggesting? Just so that people understand, particularly people who are not in the system and who are not very aware with the different provincial dynamics that occur. I mean, the one thing that we do know and that we've heard about perpetually at these hearings would be the issue of the lack of support that teachers feel with regard to things like psychological services or social welfare services and so on, which, you know, clearly districts are meant to provide but are not doing so. Part of the reason, and we haven't quite understood, you know, I guess there are different dynamics in different places, but we haven't quite understood why that is. In some instances, clearly, there have been submissions from district officials themselves who say, well, you know, I'm responsible for 600 schools. How on earth can I go and support all of them? So those issues we do know of. But clearly, you've got a more refined understanding of the system. And perhaps if you were to, I don't want to say supplement so much, because it's quite a detailed input that you've given. It's just difficult for me to understand, to be honest. So if you would be so kind as to do that for us in the simple way that you've done it today, I think it would be enormously useful when we go back to your submission, when we do the report as well, and then to take up some of your recommendations, which you can then make very succinctly in that document as well, please.
No, I think that's fine. Obviously, are you saying that we should go from here and then and give you and send something to your office again, forward something to your office again?
Please.
Because what we've done this afternoon, we've actually reframed here and I've put together quite a graphic, a sort of a PowerPoint presentation, which I thought would have gone well down here, but we opted to come and talk here this afternoon to you rather, instead of boring people with some graphic stuff. But I think the graphic explanations of what you want to do, the paradigm shift. But if you want me to answer quickly, just one of those two, those things I can answer you, you know.
Well, I wanted to give the opportunity to some of the members as well to add to those questions. Mine was just a request to do that. But if you've got the PowerPoint presentation and if you think that responds to what I've requested you to do, please, by all means, leave it with Mr. Brown and we'll go through it. And then if we have questions, we can always then contact you telephonically as well. I've got Mr. Lorimer. Ms.
Mishwan.
Go ahead.
Mr. Forbes, two questions. Firstly, how easy would it be to apply the circuit team's method given the personnel and practices currently in place? So in terms of that question, would it require more personnel, different personnel, more money, how much? And the second question was to find out more about your pilot project going on in PE. How long has it been running? And when do you expect it to end? And when do you expect to have results?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Foss. The second thing that you're talking about, I think it's an excellent idea, except that for the past 2 years, we like had second teams. Unfortunately, I think the unfortunate part is that the ideal is there, the documentation is there, but the teams are not there. Like I don't want to talk of provinces that I don't know of, but I know for a fact that in Limpopo, this framework is there. But in a circuit where you are supposed to have 49 staff, I know that you are talking of faking, including the cleaners, and maybe six curriculum advisors, and the rest of them were not employed. Such that, yes, the idea is there, but if the personnel is not there, then it becomes a challenge. You speak of Western Cape. I want to believe that maybe in the Western Cape, it's full of like if it's 49, maybe they're all there. And I want to believe that it has been running ahead for the past 6 years, if I remember correctly. Like that, yeah, it has been there, not necessarily this past year, but it has been there for this past year. Now the question is, how do you think this will change the employment methods? Because I think that's the challenge, that we do have a plan in place, but we need human resource, which we do not have. For sure, what you're talking about, if you go to Limpopo, they'll tell you, yes, this is the ideal plan. We have this ideal plan, but we do not have the personnel. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I must say to you, ma'am, and I've spoken to Professor Erin Ngankulu. You know Professor Erin Ngankulu? He's from your part of the world, from Limpopo. He's been saying to me, Andre, I've got more than 576 officials sitting in the head office of the education department in the province, and I don't know what to do with them. And the big problem, and the big fight we've got now in the Eastern Cape, because of, and they want to go this way, but it's the fight between the senior officials who have gone into the provincial administration and who should now be going back into the districts at that post level, and who are saying, well, we have packed up everything where we live, and now you want to send us back to where we came from. Okay. So that is the biggest fight in terms of getting the officials, okay, to adhere to. But let me come back to the first question. How easy would it be to apply? I think we don't need to wait for the pilot project to run its course in Port Elizabeth. For the past 2 years, the Western Cape Education Department, right here on your doorstep, they've been implementing the circuit teams. And I'm sure they've got sophisticated systems in place to track budgets and cost and personnel, etc., etc. And that will give us a good indication of what it really took them to implement the system on the ground. And you've got everything here at your disposal. You can just press a button and they will give you that information. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and this is a different, to answer your question, we are saying at the moment we've got an EDO who goes into his 60 schools or 30 schools and then goes back into the district office. And on another day, somebody from curriculum, a curriculum advisor for the foundation phase, will go into the school and go back. They are not talking to one another. There's no integration. There's no planning together. And what happened here, the Western Cape Education Department went through three organizational review processes. Three. And they've settled on their circuit team concept. And what they've done is they've recognized the fact that we had multifunctional teams in the past. Yes, multifunctional teams. But they were operating in silos still. And if you ask a district director in the Western Cape now, let's go to Mr. Eugene Daniels in the Middlesbrough Metropole, and I'm deliberately using him because he's got some serious disadvantaged schools and areas in his district. He will say to you that I can vouch that the circuit team concept has made my task so much easier when I started here in 2001. It's just only from 2008 when we introduced the circuit teams that have actually managed to turn this district around. And in that regard, I've brought all the senior officials from the Eastern Cape, from Port Elizabeth District Office, here for a week and a half to come and shadow a circuit team in practice, in school, every day, for them to see how this mechanism we're talking about, the mechanism, can this mechanism work in practice on the ground? And it's wonderful to see how the circuit teams, under a circuit team leader, sit and plan and meet and talk about issues. So when a labor matter arrives, if a teacher doesn't receive a salary in one particular school, it gets raised at a Monday meeting and somebody addresses it immediately and by Friday somebody will have an answer. So you will have a team of people, institutional managers and governors, admin development advisors to help the school with the administration, learning support advisors for remedial teaching, an admin clerk, a social worker, a school psychologist, all three phases of the curriculum. That team of people work then, but the difference is where they don't have the expertise, they can call them then on service providers from outside to assist the department where they don't have that expertise. At the moment, on our circuit team, because GM's got a little bit of finance, we can finance those people from outside where we don't have that expertise on the circuit team. And that's why we've done a complete audit of those schools to look at, especially at education support services. And I see some people in the house here that I've seen at the Mitchell's Bay Metropole South, at NISA, and those people in the house. So that is the difference that we're talking about here. And I don't think our people has got this quality of a feeling of working together at district level. Now, if you don't get that team right, those people that must actually work in the schools on a day-to-day basis, who else is going to take the department into the schools? You don't need an inspector. If you've got a circuit team, then you've got a departmental presence every day in those schools. And that is the difference that we're talking about here. You can have the whole bureaucracy, national, province, district, but who goes into the schools? Who? All those policies mean absolutely nothing. Unless you get that support right there, then we can talk about improving the outcomes of our learner performances in the school. Just think about that. We can argue ourselves blue in the face as we're sitting here. We're not going to turn the system around unless we get those people into the schools. Then there was another one. I don't have all the answers, ma'am. If I don't know the answer, I will tell you I don't know. Randall, if I don't know, I don't know. You know me by now. In any case, the Port Elizabeth project has been going. We're just lagging behind Cape Town. And we're twinning with Cape Town. And now, obviously, Gauteng is going to come on board now. But they're going to do a phased intervention. And we are saying that the circuit team can be incrementally phased in. Madam Chair, we don't need to have all those people initially on a circuit team. Especially in the rural areas, we can have somebody for literacy and numeracy on that team only, and somebody for institutional management and governance as a start for a team. So you don't need a whole hog. And that's what I'm saying to you, incrementally, we can phase this thing in as a seed that can take root right throughout the country. 3 years, we're looking at a 3 year period. We've been through the last 18 months for this project. It's only last year, August, that I brought the, my circuit team up here to shadow the Western Cape circuit team. So we're recording, taking lessons, learning lessons, and they are obviously now 2.5 years ahead of us. And we're learning from them and they're learning from us. And we are all the time sharing notes. And we're glad to have Mr. Eugene Daniels and his team of people, you know, coming across the country with us to fund this message. I forgot what the other one was, but Roger's also here next to me because he was part of his presentation, you see. He can't just sit here and he must also answer some of his questions. Roger.
The boss, Andrea, I can do it alike. Just one more in closing. To me, the whole purpose of education is to give children skills to enable them to survive and prosper in the future. That's what education is about. And the best way we've decided to do this is at schools. Right. The school, and we need to train teachers and we need to train principals. There's no doubt about that. But there are a whole lot of things that we also need to do, and that is provide constant support to the schools when they need it and even when they think they don't need it, but in fact do need it. They need to know what they don't know, and then be helped to deal with it. To me, having hundreds of officials whose very existence has no impact at all on the skilling of kids in schools is crazy. How can they be in the Department of Education? I'm in the Department of Education because they're not contributing towards this drive of getting kids skilled at school. So one of the problems that Mr. Lorimer raised is the cost. Yes, sure, if you're going to bring in a whole circuit team overnight for every circuit across the country, it's going to need a heck of a lot of personnel, with very highly skilled personnel as well. As Andre said, you can phase it in. But you've got to offset that by how many of those people in Zwelitsha and other provincial offices could not be redeployed out into the districts where they would be far more productive and probably far more happier in their jobs because they would actually be able to influence things in schools. So it's not just a one-sided thing, this is going to cost too much money. I think we've got to say, if we do it, if we decentralize properly, we can actually save a whole lot of money up here to offset those costs. So I think we've got to be really careful about how we cost it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now, as you were answering those questions, more questions would have arisen, and we don't have time for that. But I hope that the further submission that I asked you for is going to address some of these critical issues. The issue, for example, of having 600 schools under a district and how totally impossible it is to support that. I take it your model addresses some of those issues as well. And I'm not asking you to respond to questions now, but if you would be so kind, both of you, to ensure that we have all of your contact details as well, so that we'll look at your slide presentation that you've got, which you will hand to Mr. Brown now. And if we do have some questions on clarity, and that thing looks very complicated to me. Right off the mark, I see a diagram there that looks very complicated. Okay, so it's something, look man, it's something that I would understand, which means like, something really basic. And something that will, but particularly important for me, is, one of the crucial things that I found enormously difficult to understand is the disparities between provinces and practices between provinces. So if you do have something like that shows us exactly what is happening in each province and what works, for example, in the Western Cape with your Western Cape model that's adjusted, that would certainly clarify things a whole lot more. So I think you have a sense of what I'm saying. Unlike yourself, I'm not an expert as to what happens on the ground in those various districts. Yeah? Okay. Thank you so much for both your input and I must say your guiding principles were fairly clear. And they certainly do assist us in understanding some of these issues. And certainly your presentation here today certainly did help us. So we hope to engage with you further, and we certainly will take on board some of your recommendations when we do consider our report. Could I suggest that we go on to the next submission? Who's next? Not at all. And I do thank you very much. We do thank you very much for attending today. Thank you. Next is Mr. Hajani. Do you have to use the computer, Mr. Hajani?
No.
Are you just giving us a presentation?
Yes.
Okay, you can sit there and use the mic. No problem, whichever you feel comfortable with.
The problem is that I've been a teacher for 10 years, so I'm already. There is a certain degree of violence. I think in kickstarting this, I need to actually stress that OVP is carrying this programming on the brain more than it encourages the unfolding of the data. And we've got to actually understand that OVP is not the teacher center that programs the brain, but it's there for the learners to achieve their outcome for the entire group of the Constitution. That is there to address the social imbalances, social injustices. That is the main thing, among other things, about OPD. But to go specifically in my line, is I think that one thing the history of South Africa transits to a transforming country. It is now divided into basic education and higher education. Like a car that needs fuel, education needs support for quality education. The outcome of quality education is through service delivery, and specifically my role in basic education is to provide care and support. And how is that actually provided? There are different vehicles through which that is provided. Inclusive education is a division, and then there are subdivisions, which is psychological services, which is therapeutic services, institutional mental support services, etc. But I belong to social services. And then the literature says, at this moment, I'm tasked to do literature fetch. And what is the purpose of doing that literature fetch? Is to help my other colleagues to identify the children in the school that have got problems. So what am I doing? I'm literally empowering my colleagues so that when they are in the classroom, they'll be able to, as I said, identify children with learner process, barriers to learning, and through referral systems, to move maybe from psychological services, social services, and so forth. So the division in inclusive education coordinates activities of subdivision, and later it makes recommendations as to how those programs are going to be solved. And the provision of social services like education, health, social welfare, and so forth is through different vehicles. That, among other things, enables children and youth to access education. And how do they access this education? They can access this education by getting the funding from the business sector, by getting the funding from the government, by getting the funding from the NGOs, the NGOs, the CBOs, etc. And we must not lose sight that our role of care and support is not in isolation. It's geared towards the children in the classroom who, among other things, operate within the model and the framework of outcome-based education. And that, and the support of the children is not the end on its own. Within inclusive education, there are different subdivisions, which among other things is institutional learner support services, which include different kinds of stakeholders. And it's interesting to note that within inclusive education, we don't only concentrate in the school, because it actually extends to the community, to the indigenous community, it extends to the local community, the province, the national, and the international. And among other things, we actually know that myself as an education specialist, I don't have to lose sight of some of the curricula and activities of the children. But I've got to also stress at the same time, I am specializing in social services. Whereas there are other people in co-curricula services who know the intricacies of co-curricula services. But myself, I can only account to social services activities as is within my job description. And I need to also mention that in the right regional curriculum statement, we've got 8 learning areas, and there are learning programs, and those learning programs, they are there with the learning program for the learner and the teaching program for the teacher. We are actually there to facilitate the achievement of outcomes both for the teacher and both for the learner. But not only there, the outcome for the institution itself. But not for the institution itself, only the outcome for the nation. And what are the outcomes for the nation to establish a democracy, a non-racial and non-sexist South Africa? That is enshrined within the constitution of South Africa. And I need to also mention that anyway, I already embarked on the one of this is within physical outcomes. But it is also very, very important, very, very critical to know that the children don't just go to school to learn about their social environment and so on. They've got to actually learn, as some other presenters said, mentioned, the mechanism of acquiring knowledge. They've got to learn to collect data, to think creatively, and to make logical conclusions. That is a didactic element which is essential in education. It's one important element or one critical factor that should characterize each and every model of education. And I need to further say that access to provision, access to education is among other things on practical basis now. I think in the past there's been a very big workload of the teachers, particularly on supportive level. That is, it has been one in the ratio of 1 to 10, but in order to expedite or to facilitate rapid movement, it should be reduction of the ratio into 1:6. So in that manner, that would also support the teacher. The teachers wouldn't be overloaded with one. They wouldn't be overloaded with now. So that would actually correct, that would in a sense have care about the teacher more than it's not that it cares about the children. So we've got to realize that the teachers are also role players. Much as the managers are also the employer is a role player, the teachers are role players, the pupils or the learners are role players. So there should be a balance. We've got to strike a balance so that all stakeholders, in a sense, are relatively satisfied. And I think this kind of project should be pushed or driven by the government and other type of donors, among other things. So what I said earlier is that my job and the essence, the pivot of my job is in supporting the children who are in need of us, the vulnerable, the at-risk, and stressed children. So this type of learners, they might be exposed to different media or to different ambiences or different types of situations that make them vulnerable. And what can be that? It can be poor environment. It can be informal settlements that are on its own oppressive, that are on its own exposing the children to vulnerability. And in the end, this type of children would in the end remain to be in trouble with the law or in conflict with the law. So we've got to guard against them. We've got to prevent these measures by, among other things, providing care and support. And in this case, inclusive education can be or is a vehicle to be preventative to negative emotions of children in trouble with the law. And among other things, I should actually conclude, normally in every presentation I don't get too long. I should also say that there are different types of biases, but what I'm actually saying here is not really based in the wheel, actually. And I'm very sure that most of us who are here, they know exactly what I'm saying. I'm just actually trying to add the voice to other voices that have been added before. But the problem about South Africa is that we tend to proliferate information. Somebody else will say what I'm saying in many different other languages, but then we have the very same thought. But we don't concentrate in expediting service delivery. Yeah. I think by that I'm through. Just to say that on a practical basis, with my colleagues, the implementation is going on, and there are statistics of leather cases, and skills are, among other things, transferred within the ambit of life. Thank you very much, Madam.
Members?
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you, Mr. Hajan. Did I pronounce it correctly? Yeah, there are two things that I want to speak to. You also came with a very good plan, but I just need to check with the teacher pupil ratio of 1:10. Are you speaking of in South Africa? Okay, yeah. Thank you. Because I wanted to check. You see, maybe my challenge is that I'm from there. I speak like a person who's from there because I'm from there. I know that it's like 1:34, 1:40. And the language that you're speaking is excellent. If we can move to that, it will be excellent. But I know for a fact, maybe it's different provinces. The 1:10 in South Africa is still a dream. Yeah. Thank you. So the next one.
Mr. Hajani, just wait till the end of the question. Just take note.
The next one. The next one is the issue of inclusive education. You talk of different learners in a classroom, which is definitely true that you see, learners must not be kept in different classes because of their physical disparities. But it's good to talk of inclusive education, where you put them in the same class and come with methods or approaches that will be able to assist all learners. And believe it or not, that's why one is so surprised, because the language you're speaking is the language that we speak of in Parliament, the inclusive education. We're talking about it. But the implications, again, it's like you are coming with things that if they can be implemented, it's not like we're hearing inclusive education for the first time today. No, we know of it, and we have been told, questions have been even checked through the hazard. The questions were there about inclusive education, and it is said it's happening. All we need is maybe a data. I don't know if you have the expectation to go and check how many inclusive education institutions do we have at present, because we know of a few. And yeah, I think that's it from me. Thank you, and please forgive me for many questions. It's like it's like I'm part of this.
Johnny, I was quite excited when I received your submission, because you spoke about the issue of orphans in your submission, and today you didn't mention that once. I'm just worried that we're going to lose sight of why it is that we called you here. We didn't really call you here to speak about inclusive education per se, but remember the topic of discussion in the public hearings about access. Well, one of the big themes is access. And clearly the issue of orphans and orphans accessing the education system was a big issue for us. And yours was one of the few submissions that actually raised the issue of orphans and their plight. What I want to find out, while you've given us a good written submission on basically from a definition of an orphan right up to the legal framework within which social services actually exist for such children, perhaps you might want to give us a sense from your experience in the Northwest. What is your experience in terms of the suitability and the adequacy of services for orphans, particularly from your experience? Secondly, to what extent, in your experience, is the issue of orphans a problem? In other words, do we have quite a few of these children who are not accessing schools or are having problems accessing schools? I know you also spoke about the availability of services through the I forget what the terminology is, but it's it's not places of safety, but it's the institutions run by social development where orphans actually get skilled and are exposed to different kinds of trades and so on. Pardon? Yeah, but there is a different terminology that you use in your submission. I forget what that is for those institutions. But notwithstanding that, if you could maybe just, I'll find it now as you speak. But if you could maybe give us a sense, because I thought, having read that part of your submission, that you were actually not so sure that those things were a good idea. In terms of skills and exposing young orphans to skills. I got the impression, sort of reading between the lines, that there was slight discomfort about it. Maybe you want to speak to that and just clarify me on whether, in fact, you think that those services are, in fact, useful, whether they are enhancing the quality of life of many of our children who happen to be orphans.
So, we've got to see the difference.
I've got Mr. Khanyako, but let me just ask you, just very specifically, is there a problem in the Northwest with children who are orphans not attending school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, what is the extent of that in your experience?
In fact, my colleague, as I actually mentioned,
I'm really just interested in whether, you know, what the extent of the problem is. So if you're telling me there are 5 orphans in the whole of the Northwest who are not attending school, I'll say that the scale of the problem is not as big as if your answer were to be about 5,000. Okay? So if you don't have the figures right now, can I suggest that you get that to us as soon as possible? And then of those orphans who are at school, the issue is, are their needs taken care of? You make the point in your submission that, in fact, when it comes to such children who are really extremely vulnerable, that it can't be that we just look at their education and the time that they spend at school, because there's also issues around the entire day that have to be managed, from the time they wake up, that they wake up in a safe place, to the point where they have to get uniforms, access transport to get to school. And then what happens to them after school? Where do they go? They have to have safe places and so on. Now, that clearly, when you say, you know, we're busy rolling out, there's implementation, that doesn't help me very much in terms of identifying exactly what is the situation currently on the ground. What is the extent of the problem, and where is it that you recommend that our resources go, and where should we as policymakers focus our attention in order to assist to bring about the kind of ideal world that you're speaking about now, right? So, okay. Now that's fine, Ms. Ajani. If you can't, then you can't. I'm not going to press that issue. Let me ask, I've got Mr. Khanyako wants to ask a quick question.
Thank you, Chairperson. Page 9 of the presentation addresses the definition of offense and so on. But as I go through this, I begin to wonder what the difference would be between a single parent orphan and a child who comes from a single parent family, where one of the parents has just disappeared. See, my problem here is it's like this whole thing is based on support and care, you know, parental care and support. But now I'm beginning to think about now another group of children who are really, in my opinion, not orphans. One parent is alive. No, both parents are alive, but the other one has disappeared. You understand what I mean when I say the other parent has disappeared? Yeah, have you also thought of this addressing? Because to me, it's like they face the same problem. Whether my father is alive or dead, if I don't know him, I don't know whether I should regard myself as an orphan. So that's where I have a problem.
Are there special dispensations, particularly given the education system in your department, in particular social services, that pertain to orphans that don't pertain to the kind of kids that Mr. Khanyako is talking about?
Yeah.
go there, Mr. I'm trying to establish, are there services that you provide to orphans who would be regarded as orphans in the definition that you wouldn't provide to those other kids?
Well, yes.
I think
you know, we've run out of time seriously with the submission. Can I suggest, are you going to be around, Mr. Hajani? Yeah, you're going to be here still at the end of our hearing. I think members do want to engage with you further, and so please make yourself available to them, okay? I'm sorry, we have run out of time, so, yeah. Thank you very much. Welcome, is that Ms. Bradshaw? Welcome to you. And please, you have now 10 minutes to take us through your presentation.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for the opportunity for Amasango to be able to be a voice for street children and other after-school youth who are not in, who need help. I think that our submission is really focusing on the rights of severely disadvantaged children to have an appropriate education. That the child on the street, the child who is a dropout, the child who is umalusi in the felt, has the same right to education as any other child in this country. We are all justifiably shocked when they are discussing rapes and murders, but particularly rapes on the elderly and the very young, by young people who do not seem to understand the value of human life. And yet we as a society have allowed ourselves to become numbed to the sight of children being at traffic lights, in shopping areas, outside bars at night, of children who have turned to prostitution to survive, who run drugs for drug lords, who are involved in theft, muggings, and housebreaking. Yet these two things surely have to be linked. If children grow up with a life experience that teaches them that human life is of no value, why are we surprised when they don't value our lives and our property as they become older? The problem is so enormous that I think most of us feel that there's nothing we can do to make a difference. It is too expensive. But we as Amasango ask, what is the cost of not tackling the problem? What is the cost in human suffering of both victims and perpetrators of these crimes? Surely the cost of running prisons far outweighs the establishment of specialized education units that would help many of these children to pick up their lives and start again, enabling them to become productive members of society. In the 19 years since starting the first of the Amasango schools in the Eastern Cape in East London, we have proved that it is possible to rehabilitate many of these lost children, lost and hopeless children. Years ago, one of them wrote in an English essay when he was in grade 10, "I used to feel like a stone stuck in mud." Today he's a taxi driver. His brother, his younger brother, won a scholarship to an Auckland-bound college in Denmark and now runs his own tourist business outside East London, taking people backpacking up the Transkei coast. He was a street child from the age of 9. How do we do our work? First of all, we admit children by self-referral. Street kids are independent, feral children who have been used to running their own lives. You can't force them in through gates. You won't keep them if you force them in through gates. But if they make choices to ask for help, they follow their choices. They are independent people. We find that when police and social workers or concerned citizens bring them to school, they seldom stay very long. We interview children on arrival. We get as much history from them as we can. Often it's all lies because they don't want to be taken back home. But we take what we can from them and we do baseline tests in order to establish their current education level, because these children come from very different educational backgrounds. Some of them have never been at school. Others have been on the streets for years and have forgotten a lot of what they learned. So we base what grade to put them into on their current academic level on the day they write their baseline test at school, irrespective of academic intelligence or age or former school reports. And we establish from these baseline tests whether the children have a basic foundation in education. And we explain to children that education is just like building an RDP house. Most of them know that RDP houses have foundations. Their shacks don't. But their RDP houses have foundations. They understand what a foundation is. And we explain to them that if you are lacking a foundation, your education will blow away, just the same as a house without a foundation will blow away. And the kids understand that, and we explain to them that if we dig a foundation and we pour concrete in underneath, your education can stand despite the difficulties you've had in life. And they understand that simple graphic example. And every child is treated as an individual, and we allow children to proceed through the first few grades at their own pace, doing the baseline tests quarterly so that we can assess with a tool whether they are ready to move to the next grade or not. We also underpin basic literacy and numeracy in the first four grades with preschool activities, because many of these children have been hard little adults who've experienced and seen stuff that many of us have only read about, and they have never been children. And so through opportunity to play, opportunity to learn to do jigsaw puzzles and play with dominoes, we unlock the child inside. We help them to learn to concentrate. And then they are better enabled to access the formal curriculum. We crash course them into a full formal curriculum in grade 5. We also do a lot of arts and culture to enable them to have things that they find is fun. We want school to be fun for them because their previous experience of school was negative. They are the kids who were the failures. They have dropped out. They are the people that are referred to as those bad children. And we want them to know they're not bad. They are not the cause of their circumstances, and God loves them, and so do we, however anybody may understand God. Now, people ask us what is our success rate, and about 20% of children who come to Amasang will drop out. Many of them do try again. We never turn a child away who's dropped out. Causes of dropping out, the first one is overcrowding. We have 130 children in our school at the moment, and that is in 6 little classrooms. It's very overcrowded. And each year, we have children who just can't cope when the classrooms are too full. But the staff have made a decision never to turn a child away who asks for help, because if we do, that child will interpret it as rejection and may never ask for help again. So if they drop out and come back next year, that's okay. We didn't reject them. They made a choice to move. Street children and other damaged, emotionally damaged children don't trust adults. In their experience, adults have failed them at every turn. Community engagement is thus critical. negative attitudes to the children by society at large must be changed. Their parents and caregivers are encouraged to engage with the school as far as possible. We actually currently have a chairman of our SDB who is the father of two street children, and he was a drunk on the streets until he saw his children starting to go to school in uniforms. And he reformed, and he has said quite publicly that Amasango has not only saved his children but restored his family to sanity. Staff have to be willing to go the distance. This takes an extra commitment to love and care for the children, to be there for them in their times of crisis. A second major cause of dropping out is drug addiction, and this is a very major problem amongst street children. Despite all the help and support we give, some kids despair and return to the streets because their bodies are pushing them for the drugs. It is heartbreaking to see them degenerate when they're back on the streets. Sometimes a long spell in prison will help them break their addiction if they haven't been able to get them in a children's unit. I cannot overemphasize the need for professional juvenile drug rehabilitation centers. I feel absolutely desperate when a boy or 15 or 16 will sit and cry in my office and say, "Mama Jane, I can't stop, the drugs rule me." Interdepartmental cooperation amongst education, health, welfare, police and justice is critical if South Africa is going to take seriously the plight of street children. There are no juvenile drug rehabilitation centres for our kids anywhere near Grahamstown. The hospital won't give them a bed, as they say it's a waste of time. They come in, take the bed of a critical ill person, go through cold turkey, and 6 days later they're back on the drugs. They need an extended period of time of professional assistance to come off drugs. The third cause of dropping out of Amasango, out of our specialized school, is teenage pregnancy and HIV/AIDS. If the children do not trust us enough to confide their problems to us, they drop out without our help and support. The emotional damage caused by rape is enormous, and when this is aggravated by HIV infection on top of the rape, it is understandable that some girls become hopeless and just give up. How do we control these children? They have huge behavioral problems, huge emotional problems. Some of them come to school with weapons. Violence is the only form of conflict resolution they've ever experienced. It's the only form they know how to practice. Our discipline is very consistent. Consistent application of discipline is critical in dealing with all children, more so damaged children, and things must be seen to be fair. Boundaries have not been part of bringing up our learners, and if they do not learn to accept boundaries, they will never rehabilitate successfully. Therefore, we preach choices and consequences ad nauseam. Some of our basic rules are, if you walk in through the gate, you'll be searched. Once you're in the grounds, you'll be expected to stay at school for the whole day. If you have been issued with a uniform, you will be expected to wear it. If you don't, you'll be sent home to get into it. Children who refuse to enter their classrooms will sit in the passage outside the office until they are ready to comply, guarded by a security guard. Children who refuse to participate at all in any tasks given by the teachers will be brought to the office. Children who commit acts of violence in the classrooms and grounds will be brought to the office. We have zero tolerance to crime. We involve the police when serious crimes are committed at school. This is tough love in the true sense of the word. If children do not understand before they are 18 that there are consequences to crime, they will end up in an adult cell where in all likelihood they will be sodomized and they will be tattooed with the gang tattoos. I've seen it too often. We also explain that unless they are already habitual criminals, they will not go to prison, but will be sent on a diversion course which will help them to grow. We never expel these children. We love them unconditionally. They are often back at school within 48 hours, and then I counsel them personally. If they do not have an adult to support them in court, we do the job. And the magistrates are no longer surprised if I stand up as both the complainant and in loco parentis for that child. We work on a basis of no work, no pay. Our school is not a feeding scheme. We feed the children three times a day, but it is first and foremost a school, and therefore if they refuse to do any schoolwork, they don't eat. We want them to understand that we are a school, not a soup kitchen. I would like to draw your attention in my document. It's on page 4 of my submission. It's right at the end of your thick document, I think, of the World Declaration on Education for All. And I'm going to read two paragraphs. To serve the basic learning needs of all requires more than a recommitment to basic education as it now exists. What is needed is an expanded vision that surpasses present resource levels, institutional structures, curricula, and conventional delivery systems, while building on the best in current practices. And then it goes on to say, an active commitment must be made to removing educational disparities. Underserved groups, the poor, street children, rural and remote populations, etc., should not suffer any discrimination in access to learning opportunities. We cannot continue with a blanket approach of one size fits all. It doesn't. The number of dropouts from mainstream education speaks volumes. Vocational education for overage learners in primary schools who are not making exceptional academic progress is the route to follow in order to divert them from a life of dependency and crime. In conclusion, I would like to add that the police in Grahamstown are important partners. They visit the school regularly, involve us in crime prevention strategies for youth at risk, and they affirm that Anasango is an asset to the town. I thank you.
Thank you, and on that note, may I just echo those sentiments. Members? Ms. Kubai, Dr. Plopisvilden, go ahead.
One of the issues that I think is quite important is the issues around youth and children in conflict with law. That mainly, normally we sometimes tend to forget in terms of rehabilitating them and making sure that they're integrated into society, and which becomes a greater problem for all of us as the society. And I think one would need to appreciate this type of an educational institution that exists. One thing I wanted to find out is that in terms of issues of vocational teaching or learning for the children, especially those who are at their teenage level or even about maturity level, I see that you also attend to children at the age of 18 and above. Because for me, those would have been the ones that would sort of tend to see if you can get them into the vocational training. Do you have anything around that?
Thank you for
hearing. Yeah, just to check. Because for me, it's not only about us even meeting the targets of Millennium Development Goals in terms of education, or even making sure that there's education, but it's about them becoming self-sustainable individuals, especially because they would be coming from either being orphans, being in the streets, rehabilitating them in such a manner that they're able to stand up and contribute positively into the society. For me, that's quite critical. But secondly, I want to understand from the level of inclusivity, how are you able to talk? Because if they remain isolated for a longer period and not integrated into society as well, how are you dealing with that? Making sure that as much as they're there, but how do you, they find a way, or how do you help them find a way of integrating with the bigger society, integrating with other kids in other schools, so that that form of integration and getting used to working with other kids and living a normal life, whether what circumstances they come from, either those of being in drugs or especially those who are often finding themselves without a choice where they are. How do we get them back into being integrated within that? But lastly, I see you did not, you were quite moderate in terms of trying to reflect how many teachers you have. I just see you say sizable number of teachers. But what does that mean, sizable number of teachers, in terms of making sure that the quality of education the kids get? Mm. Understand what you're saying, you don't have a policy of limiting the children into class. But again, how to make sure that each and every child, in terms of the quality of the education that they get, is of such a need that it reflects it as an output later. Then the other issue, lastly, Chair, it's on the children who normally would come in, go, come in, go. How do you manage that in terms of the education and their learning within the institution and their learning ability? Thank you.
I'm particularly interested in how these learners land up in your school. And are you at all involved in or deal with the reasons why these children get lost? More specifically, you mentioned the dropout from mainstream education. Do you have statistics on how many learners dropped out because they had learning barriers, experienced learning barriers, in other words, the LSEN learners? And then in your document, you refer to the Mortino project. Could you give us some more information on that specifically? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, I'm covered, mostly covered, but I need to add on what they said. I wanted to talk of children off the street and children on the street. And I like the way you put it. Because those ones on the street, they come and go, like you said. But then I appreciate, definitely, the way you put it. Unless if you are not normal, nobody would appreciate what you're doing. But then, you see, we live in a wicked world. It's unfortunate. That there are places where these kids are seen as it's good for them to be off the street. They become business. Trust me, they become business. And what I like about what you said is that it's non-fee. You are not talking of, it's like you are assisting, genuinely assisting. But I know that there are places where these kids, even the ones on and off, they have to be excluded from the streamline. And that is not very good for them, because they need to live with everybody else. Now, if there is a world created for them, what are we building? What are we creating? So that is good for these ones on the street. If they go back home, that's the best place to be. So such that instead of giving them 20 cents or how much you give them on the street, and they end up taking drugs, you buy a bag of millet for the whole family, such that you are assisting. I appreciate. But lastly, it's in Grahamstown. We are talking of that only. In other places, we have seen this most. It's there, but it depends on the intention. Because as you speak to us, we know it. You can feel that it comes from within you. You want to change. You want to assist. But sometimes you listen to people who definitely want funds, and this must become a serious business. And because of that, kids are encouraged to stay in the street. And if you can advise how it can go to other provinces, that so that it can get support for sure. Nobody wants kids to be lost, poor kids to go hungry. But the values, I think the values maybe is the thing that we must deal with, because there are kids who run away from home because there is poverty. You need to sit with us and check where we come from. We didn't run from home. There was nothing to eat, you know, but we stayed. We stayed at home and went to school, and we met very rich kids, but it didn't make us think that is that there are better homes. That was us then. But there are kids these days who would rather run away from home, not because the child is abused, but because there is poverty at home, and therefore they run away. How do we assist to make kids understand the disparities of life? And to speak, and you spoke of religion and stuff, and have faith. I think that would assist. Thank you very much.
I hope I've got the essence of the questions. If I haven't, would the questioner just pull me in line, please?
Let me just add one more question, and that is about your funding model. Are you entirely privately funded, or do you get some assistance from the provincial departments?
Right. The first question was about conflict with the law and rehabilitation of children. And I really believe that this is a critical issue. And the only way we're going to rehabilitate children is for them to feel valued and loved and cared for. And why I'm saying this is, I'll give you an example. There was a boy who spent most of his time at Amasango asleep under the desk because he was so high. And eventually he was arrested and spent quite a long time in prison, like 2 years. And he was a very violent, aggressive creature. And I always thought that if any one of them stabbed me in the back in a dark alley one night, it would be him. And when he came out of prison, I was standing near the City Hall in Grahamstown, and the streets are wide, and I saw him on a far corner, diagonally opposite. And suddenly he screamed across the street, "Mola Mama Che!" So I greeted him. And then he said, in Xhosa, of course, "You see that woman standing there? I am what I am today because of her." And I thought, dear God, am I being held responsible for his criminal activity? But in actual fact, what he was trying to say was, I am a person. And I thought I'd failed him completely. And yet he had experienced the love and the care. And now he's washing cars in the middle of High Street. He's still a bit glazed at times. But he is surviving, honestly, washing cars. And that's why when people say, what is success? In a situation of 60 to 70% unemployment, you know, to start a prison is success. The various levels of success, we aim much higher than that. But that's basic success, and that's the beginnings of rehabilitation. But I think that care and love is critical, and education is critical. Because the SPCA gives care and love, but we're not dealing with animals, we're dealing with human beings. And human beings who have got any intelligence want to move forward. They want to be like other people. They want to be accepted in society. And so we need to create places where rehabilitation can take place, where there is proper care at every level, emotional, physical, spiritual, health-wise. Then, I don't know if that answers how I feel about rehabilitation to a degree. Vocational teaching and learning. I believe it's critical. Yes, your very bright child needs the opportunity to accelerate, to catch up, to get back into mainstream, and to achieve. And we have had children do that, and pass matric. 16 coming off the streets in grade 5 on Dacha and Mandrake, and passing matric with exemption, first go round. It happens. But these are exceptional children. A lot of them are still 20 in grade 7. 18 in grade 6. And they need an alternative route because mainstream education isn't going to enable them to catch up once they start going 1 year per grade. And I believe that we need to have a policy of allowing primary schools to teach vocational skills to older pupils so that we can equip them for the world of work, so that they are empowered to become, as our vision states, sorry, I found it in the intended way. I'd like to take you to our vision on page, oh dear, I've lost it. I had it a moment ago, I'm sorry. Page 3. The school's vision is to establish a school which provides an environment in which severely socially marginalized children may develop into confident, productive, independent, and interdependent members of society ready to enter the world of work. We want them to be people when they leave us who can stand for themselves, who own their humanity, and who can interrelate with other people back into society, what you were talking about, but I'll come to that more a bit later. So the vocational teaching, I started 3 schools for street children in the Eastern Cape. The first one was in East London, and that one has better facilities than the others. So there we already have welding, motor mechanics, and practical agriculture. And to equip children to be able to have skills that take them into the market is really great. And I believe that we need, wherever these schools get started, to look at what the industry is around and to teach appropriate skills so that they can answer the job needs within the area. It's no good teaching everybody to weld if they live in a rural village where there's no crime. Sorry. inclusivity into society, critical. And so we do that mainly through arts and culture with choir, marimba band, traditional dance, gumboot dancing. Our kids get invited to entertain at old age homes. We participate in the Outstedford. We play our sport with mainstream education so that the children are moving, yes, from our specialized situation up. When our kids can get gold at the Eastern Cape Outstedford, along with kids from St. Andrew's College and DSG and other private and mainstream top schools, they feel like gold themselves. And it's wonderful when that happens. And our children were invited by the British Council to go and play their marimbas and do their gumboot dancing in Port Elizabeth at the stadium for British tourists because they've heard of what our kids can do. So that builds self-esteem and it integrates them with society. Teacher numbers, we have 18 teachers currently. We are a government-registered special needs school. So all salaries are paid by the Department of Education. Our children are weighted 5. That is, one of ours equal to 5 normal children because of all their different barriers. Unfortunately, we only have 6 classrooms. That's why we're overcrowded. So we have extra teachers and extra children in every single classroom at the moment. But there is that attention to detail as far as possible, but not as much as if we had 14 classrooms and only 10 children in each classroom. Erratic attendance, it's problematic. Children come and go. But because we're teaching children at their own rate, it means that their children moving from grade to grade every quarter. So for the child who goes and comes back, he's not going to upset the teacher very much because there are other children who've moved up from a lower grade, so they fit in. But it means that some children make very little progress because they're very seldom at school. Sometimes after 2 or 3 years of being erratic, they suddenly mature a bit in their heads and they settle down. And we have had them at least past grade 7, which is great. We also, for the first time, now have 9 non-teaching staff members sponsored by the Department of Education. And on our latest list of posts, we will have 19 by the end of this year, including for the first time a nurse and a social worker, but not yet a psychologist. How did that come? What are the reasons? Poverty is the greatest reason. You know, it's fine that schools are now waiving the school fees, but the school fees is the least expense to a really poor family. Shoes, uniform, food cost far more than the school fees cost. The school fees is 10 rand a year in the average township school. But the rest is huge. And then we'll have children who say, my mother drinks the grant. And so there isn't any food. There's a lot of abuse of childcare grants. And it's a major problem. The children become marginalized. Children with severe mental handicaps, severely marginalized in terms of intelligence, we only get a handful. And there is a school for intellectually challenged children in Grahamstown. So when we establish that they're intellectually challenged, we move them across to that school. We do have quite a number of mildly mentally handicapped children, some of whom don't manage to pass grade 7, but we have a pottery, and that's our only skills development at the moment. And we're training them in slip work, and they are producing marketable mugs, plates, and teapots now, so we're very excited about that. Maltino Project was originally linked to Rhodes University, and it's the Breakthrough to Literacy program. It's in all languages in South Africa now, but originally it was only in Xhosa. And it is a different approach to reading and writing, where you move from the familiar to the unfamiliar. So you first talk about pictures and relate words to pictures. Then you start drawing pictures and having sentences written underneath, and then you later begin to break sentences into words, words into gone blank segments, and then those into letters. So the alphabet is the last thing you learn. And that works very, very well because it makes sense in the child's head, whereas the old Xhosa method of A, E, I, O, U didn't mean anything. So that's the method we're using. On and off the streets, yes. Most of our children are on the streets. And as soon as they start coming to Amasango, we encourage them to go and live at home. And we say, hang in there. We're feeding you, we're clothing you, caring for your health, we're educating you. Don't sleep on the streets. Sleep in the township. Some of them say etchomi. They move from friend to friend. But at least they're not on the streets. But the drug addicts drift back to the streets at night. That's their richest time from getting money from university students. Because if the students are a bit drunk, they just dish it out 50 rand at a time. And it's damaging. We do also have a few other Elson children at our school. We've got one boy with only one leg. We've got one boy who's deaf. But even that deaf boy is now in grade 6, which is really quite remarkable. He has got some speech and he lip reads. So he's making excellent progress. He was 16, having never been to school when we took him in. And he's got to grade 6 in 4 years. So it is possible to work with these children. So the psychosocial barrier is our primary barrier, but we don't turn down people who have secondary barriers. Shelter. Grahamstown has got a street children's shelter. It takes 30 boys at a time, and 30 of our children are there, but those are the cases that are really the most extreme, and a social worker assesses the home background of every child who goes into the shelter. The shelter has a social worker. Expanding this to other areas, well, the reason I made a submission is that I really believe that the Department of Education needs to take this kind of model on board nationally, because these children are everywhere. The EU gave the national police money in 2006 to do a study. At that stage, they established 400,000 street children in South Africa, 30,000 in the Eastern Cape. The three Amasango children at the most deal with 500 children. You know, we're going to have a wave of crime continuing and continuing and continuing if we don't give these children hope. And hope is through education, because that is empowerment. The funding model, we get all our salaries from the Department of Education. We get a proper special needs subsidy per capita on our books, but we don't get anything for the social care of the children. So I have volunteers from overseas, and through them a charity has been established in England. There is a person there who sponsors me to go on a speaking tour for 4 to 5 weeks over the June school holidays every year, and they are raising enough money for us to feed and clothe and send to high school, pay their fees, their high school uniforms, feed them, supply them with their high school materials that they need. So we are raising in the region of £35,000 a month to run the charity side of our project. That is causing a bit of problem in the Department of Education, because there are some officials who are saying you're meant to be a school, not a charity. But I don't think we would have the children coming to school if we weren't able to give them the social care they need. I think I've answered all the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for the time you've allowed me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And certainly, I think I would echo the sentiments of everybody here when I say that we think you and your school are doing an absolutely invaluable job. And please convey our best wishes in regards to the staff and the children at your school.
May I say one more thing? Yes. I did serve on the National Working Group for Curriculum Adaptation for Children with Barriers to Learning in Pretoria in about 2003-2004. I'm very overtired all the time and I have blank spots. And I've forgotten the name of the man who was the director at the time. From Cape Town, a Muslim man from Cape Town. Yes. We had a very good working relationship. I think it was 2003. It might have been, it was definitely 2004. I can't remember whether it was 3, 4, or 4, 5. But I flew up several times.
Very much. What I'm going to do now is I'm just going to move over to the next submission, and that is the one from the University of the Northwest, is it? I want to suggest that those of you who keep on raising your hands and so on to want to speak, that you try and engage the individual presenters perhaps later once we close, okay? Dr. Ace, over to you. 10 minutes for your presentation.
Thank you so much. I hope everyone is wide awake at this stage, mm-hmm. because it's a long, long afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen of the House and Chair, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of the Northwest University. As you can see, my passion in life is to enhance reading skills of learners, to enable learners to be able to read. Because if you can't read, you can't learn. If you can't read, you can't communicate. You can't Google. You can't work on internet. You can't send an SMS. So reading is one of the things in life that everyone should be able to acquire. Now, before I move on to my next slide, I just want to show you why I think the Minister of Education surely has the toughest job in South Africa. And there you can see In the time of Qadir Asmal, it was a blackboard jungle. He had many problems, weapons in school, the apartheid legacy. He had lots of problems. And one of the sad things is that those problems are still with us today. So those problems were added to Naledi Pandora's box. Just want to... Yes, this is a little bit slow computer. There's Pandora's box, and she had problems with English language domination, Bantu education residue, colonial schools, governing bodies, and those are still with us today. And that brings us to Angie Motshekga. And Angie Motshekga's legacy will be the death of OBE and the NCS. I really and sincerely hope that it will not be the death of OBE, because OBE is a lovely system, but it's not implemented in the right way. I really hope that we are not dishing out another lost generation. I do not hope so. We must remember that doctors bury their faults, and that's the patients. Teachers' faults, the learners, grow up, and the problems get worse. Learners become dissatisfied human beings, and in some cases, this leads to crime. Now, I would like to share the results of the Foundations for Learning campaign. It is a 2008 examination. The report is based on 1 million grade 3 and grade 6 learners from 7,000 schools. The achievements are reported on a four-level scale. And if you look there, you will see that on level 1, that is 0 to 34%, grade 3 learners, 36% of them, were on a 0 to 34% scale. In grade 6, therefore, I qualify that our problems get bigger, they don't get buried. In grade 6, when they assess the languages, they were 52%. That level 2 is 35% to 49%. Grade 4, grade 3 learners, 24% got that presentation. And grade 6 learners, 20%. So if you can refer to the numbers in red, at the end of, in grade 3, 60% of the learners got marks between 0 and 49. And in grade 6, those numbers increased to 72%. Unfortunately, there were only 25% learners that achieved marks between 50% and 69, and that became less at the end of grade 6. And our learners who achieved best, they were 15%, and then they fell down to 10% in grade 6. So we really have a problem with regards to literacy, with regards to languages. What's the situation in South Africa? In spite of the implementation of the NCS, and we still have a serious problem with regards to illiteracy. A report by the Ministerial Committee on Education in Disadvantaged Areas emphasizes the needs and skills of learners. Training, dedication, and competencies of teachers. And there's a main problem as I see it. It's not always the project, the product that the teacher has, but it's the passion in which the teacher uses the mechanisms she or he has, as well as the importance of instruction media in disadvantaged areas. A further aggravating factor within the milieu of South African education system is the complicated socio-political history of the country that created a large amount of disadvantaged schools. Because the basis of all reading and writing is laid in the foundation phase, it is necessary for steps to be taken to ensure that learners will be able to read with comprehension in their first years at school. Because if they can't read with comprehension in their first years at school, they won't be able to read, they won't be able to learn, and we can do whatever we would like to do, but that won't increase the matriculation percentage, because learners can't read. Now, I've got a possible cost-effective solution, because I know money is always an issue. I feel that teachers should explicitly teach high-frequency words and phonics, especially in the foundation phase. The younger your learner, the more emphasis there must be on phonics. The above mentioned and the NCS. Both high-frequency words as well as phonics are only mentioned in the NCS. They are there, but it's so vague that no one knows what to do with phonics. No one knows what to do with high-frequency words. No lists of words or lists of phonics that should be taught in grade 1 to 3 are documented in the NCS. Now I think you want to know what on earth is high-frequency words. High-frequency words are the words that appear most often in the spoken language and printed material. For example, I took a grade 2 reader from one of the schools, and the reader's name is Nick Glasses, and I highlighted all the high-frequency words which are listed. And these high-frequency words, which I have highlighted in white, they appear on the list of 100, the first 100. Some of the lists have 1,000 words. Some of the lists, like gold, have 220 words. But this highlighted, the white parts, are words that come from the first 100 words. And if you look at that, you will see that passage, that little booklet that grade 2 learners read, has 34 words, of which 25 are high-frequency words. So if they know high-frequency words automatically, it will definitely enhance their comprehension of reading, because their reading fluency will be much better, and therefore they will comprehend. And then I've got a list of people. There's a list of high-frequency words of Dolch. There's another one of Fry and Van Tikidis, and they have a list of 1,000 words. I also have these lists in Afrikaans as well, and currently one of my students at university is busy compiling words, high-frequency words in Setswana. She's doing her PhD on that. So I would really love if we could give teachers lists of high-frequency words in Afrikaans, English, Setswana, Zulu, everything, and they can hammer on those words. Together, I did, before I started on this project, I did, I collected data at schools, and I worked especially in three schools in Northwest. One of them was a former Model C school, and two of the schools were formerly disadvantaged schools. And I found that schools who do teach high-frequency words, the learners were able to read with comprehension. And the second leg of my research was to go to a formerly disadvantaged school and to go in there and have an experimental group and a control group. The experimental group, I taught 100 high-frequency words. I went to school for 6 months, and I negotiated with a headmaster, and I was at school from 8 to 10 every day. And I taught those learners the high-frequency words as well as the phonics that go with them. And if you can see there, at the beginning, the experimental group, their word recognition wasn't as high as the control group. Their reading age wasn't as high as the control group. Their chronological age, that is how old they were on the time when I was busy with my project, That's what this says. But you will see there that the experimental group, their comprehension was much, much lower than the control group. So then, of the experimental and control group, after intervention, I went in for that 6 months, and I taught them, explicitly taught them phonics, as well as high-frequency words within the context of passages, because you have to relate to real-life circumstances if you want to read with comprehension. And after that, I was very, very pleased with the results, because the control group, they only went on with ordinary schoolwork during those 6 months. But the experimental group, I was with them, and I must put you at ease, at the end of my research, I went back to the control group and I also gave them the same instruction as the experimental group, because it was such valuable, so valuable to the learners. If you can see there, now the word recognition is slightly higher than that of the control group. You will see that the reading age is now slightly higher. The chronological age is still the same, but the comprehension significantly improves. And reading is only successful if you can comprehend. There's a comparison between the pre and the post group, the experimental group. You can definitely see how they gained from this research project. And there's a comparison between the pre and post test of the control group. You will see, funnily enough, I can't explain that, there was a drop in their comprehension, which I cannot really explain. Please don't make that one of the questions, because I can't explain it. And now, am I the only researcher that thinks that high-frequency words is of value? No. And how should we teach it in schools? I say that we must supply teachers with a list of words. And now that English is becoming more and more important in the foundation phase as well, to make sure that learners will be able to learn in grade 4 in English, I think in Afrikaans schools, they must get the Afrikaans list as well as the English list. In English schools, they can get the English list, and if there are Setswana learners in their school, if Setswana is the first additional language, then they can have that list as well. And we must train teachers in the teaching thereof. There's no, you can't just give them something and not help them to use it. You can't give me a Porsche and not teach me how to drive the Porsche, because there's a big difference between my Honda and a Porsche. And many researchers stress the importance of the first 100 words on the list. Now, Kathy Shem said, recognizing these words by sight is within less than a second, is critical to developing fluency in reading. Robert Hillerich said, just three words, I and this, account for 10% of all words in printed English. Edward Dahl said, over 50 to 75% of the most commonly used words are found in the Dutch list, and the Dutch list only consists of 220 words. Students of the module Literacy at the Northwest University established that the first 100 words accounted for 68% of reading material used in the foundation phase. And the reading material used in this action research was not readers that learners read in class. It was booklets and books that the teachers read to the learners. So it was on a higher level, and still, the first 100 words consisted 68%. The frequency in which high-frequency words should be taught, because these words have to be automatically, like your name. You can see your name, you're going to have a list of names, and you will see your surname within seconds, because it comes automatically to you. So in order to automatize those words, we have to take it slow. In the first quarter of grade 1, only words 1 to 10. Second quarter, 11 to 30. But the secret is to continually come back to those words and to revise them, to repeat them within passages, on word cards, on word walls, in dominoes. You can play a word dominoes, etc. There's a whole exposition of how I think it should be introduced in schools. And here I've got an outline of phonics that should be taught. I trained teachers when I was in teaching. I trained teachers from disadvantaged areas. And when I gave them this, they were always so happy, because now they know what to do. Because our teachers do not know what to do, and if they know what to do, they do not know how to do it. So we have to give them something to work on. These are just... And now, Albert Einstein once said, there are two ways to live your life. One is as if nothing is a miracle. The other is as if everything is a miracle. But I say, the explicit teaching of high-frequency words and phonics are miracles. There's my contact details, and there's a lovely fat man. It's not finished until the fat man sums. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. S, for that methodology, and which, you know, just goes to show you that you don't need hugely expensive material to be very effective in teaching, certainly when it comes to reading. One of the things that we had discussed previously in the hearing before this one was the proposal to the department to establish some kind of forum where people with these kinds of ideas could actually showcase their work and their research and so on. And this sounds to me to be one of such a candidate. It's very easy to put some of these lists, for example, onto the website, you know, as teaching aids and tools for teachers who are struggling with teaching, reading, and so on. So thank you very, very much for that. The Afrikaans was a bit difficult to read, but I must say your English is much better than my Afrikaans. And a lot of what you said here is actually incorporated in that submission. But I think nonetheless it would be nice to get the English presentation that you made to make it easy for us when we do the report, those of us who are linguistically challenged. And Mr. Bundy's smiling as well, so I guess he's going to be very happy too. Thank you very much, Dr. Ace. Members, I think that does it for the day. I do want to urge those of you who still want to engage with some of the people who have submitted to take the opportunity to do so. I know some of you need to rush off and catch planes and so on, so we'll try not to delay you any further. Just to remind you that tomorrow we meet in the morning. We have a morning session, and that begins at 9:30 in the Old Assembly Chamber, Mr. Brown. Old Assembly Chamber. And we'll be sitting till 11:45. 12 o'clock tomorrow. Okay? Thank you very much, and have a safe journey wherever you're traveling.